There it goes. If everybody can get seated, we'll get going again. And we'll hopefully get wrapped up pretty quickly. We're going to have Dr. Bloomstone come back, talk to us. And he felt like my introduction wasn't good, so he's going to reintroduce himself now. Dr. Bloomstone. Okay.
This is the microphone on. Thank you. I will not, for those of you who were not here during the first talk, I will not show any more Dr. King code talk. Nope. Although I do have a number of emails that I could share. I just wanted to quickly, I'm not starting yet, so don't start the timer. Let's see. Is it coming up? It would be helpful. Well, it would mostly be helpful. Okay, let's try a few things. I'm definitely not starting. Okay. Now, is that coming up? Perfect. Okay, now, once again, don't start the timers. I mentioned before that maybe we want to close the back door, if you don't mind. I mentioned before, I do not believe there is a rationale to the 30-day mortality thing. And let me just share with you why I think that's the case. And then please take it back to your college so we can work on something that's more individualized. This is very interesting data. What it shows is an inflection point. What kind of inflection point? When we said earlier that when somebody suffers a complication post-surgery, their long-term mortality is higher than those people who don't. The key factor is this. When you suffer a complication, there is a very dramatic drop in survival, and then you pass a certain point where survival is more like the normal. Munasinghe showed that by 3 years, you were kind of closer to baseline. But what this shows you here is this inflection point of where after surgery for a given patient is their risk of mortality likely to be baseline. What you'll notice is for each of the different surgical procedures, this inflection point is different. In fact, there is no 30-day inflection point for any surgical procedure. The one that comes closest is a hip fracture at 27 days. And then next, a cholecystectomy that's open at 33 days. But you can see that patients are at risk for post-complication, post-surgical mortality for up to 180 days after a carotid endarterectomy. So just because you pass 30 days doesn't mean that patient's out of the woods. The key thing is this. There is no and should be no specific metric of 30 days because relative to the individual patient, it doesn't really make sense and it's not evidence-based. Okay. It hasn't started yet. I grew up in Montreal. That's number one. And then I came to the U.S. I went to college in Maine, and then I did medical school in New York, as stated, at Albert Einstein. Then I went to Boston and did Beth Israel Hospital Medicine, and then MGH Anesthesia and Critical Care. And then I went to Villanova to do Six Sigma training in healthcare and lean certification. And now I'm getting my master's degree with the Division of Surgery at the University College London. Okay, the concentration is in perioperative morbidity risk stratification and determination. I do work with Valley Anesthesiology. I do almost all of my clinical work with Banner Health, and I work as a co-physician lead with Dr. King on perioperative clinical consensus and clinical practice development. Okay? The talk hasn't started yet. I want to share this with you because it's directly connected. Okay? This is a brief historical interlude. All right? This is William IV. He ascended to the throne of Great Britain in 1831. And just as he was ascending to the throne, the Blue Death, the second cholera epidemic, was sweeping across from India to Europe to Great Britain and to the Americas. Now, it particularly hit Great Britain and London specifically in a very sort of horrible way in that year. 1831, the angel of loose crap and death went over these population of patients, and over 55,000 Londoners died in 1831 of cholera. What does this have to do with anything? Well, at the time, a physician, an Irish physician in London, gives a presentation that says we have no idea what's causing this disease, but that it is legitimate to treat it by treating its symptoms. And he observed that the water that was within the blood of patients with this disease was less than in healthy patients. That is to say, the blood of patients with cholera has less water in it. But he didn't know what to do with that. But at that time, an English clinician, Thomas Latta, would do something no physician had ever done, let alone any other human, at least not that they admitted to in paper. I resolved to throw the fluid, a mixture of salts and water, immediately into the circulation. Having no precedent to guide me, I proceeded with caution. He inserts a tube into the basilic vein. This is critical. I watched the effects. Ounce after ounce was injected. Now, that's a novel concept. It's a fluid challenge. I gave some, and I watched the effect. Okay. Now, the pulse, which had long ceased, returned to the wrist. At first, it was small and quick, and then by degrees, it became more distinct, slower, and firmer. Okay. Now, then, in 1832, he describes something that is unbelievable. And we think Manny Rivers and early goal-directed therapy started this whole thing just a few years back. Some of the cases, it didn't work. Some of these patients died. And he gathered, number one, maybe the quantity that I injected of fluid wasn't enough. Maybe it needed to be repeated. Maybe it wasn't going to do anything anyway because there was too much extensive organ disease because the application of this IV fluid was just too late. That's 1832, and nothing has changed. Now, let me tell you, this little historical interlude is unofficially brought to you by Lay's potato chips. And why? Well, in one bag, one personal-sized bag of Lay's chips, there are 180 milligrams of sodium. And in one bag of normal saline, there are 9,000 milligrams of sodium. Now, nobody should recognize, but now you will, that any time you hang a bag of saline, that is exactly like giving 50 bags worth of Lay's potato chips relative to its salt content to your patient. Now, nobody can drop 3 liters of fluid faster than an anesthesiologist can, and when we do that in 1 hour, that is exactly the same thing as giving 150 bags worth of Lay's potato chips to the patient relative to the salt load. And you wonder why the patients wake up thirsty and without any urine output. The consequences of the fluids that we load our patients with are not only a function of the free water, but the tremendous salt loads that come with it. Give an ounce after ounce, okay, and watch the effects. Repeat only as needed and not a drop more. Now the lecture begins, okay? I have some disclosures to make. Number one, I am a consultant to Edwards Lifesciences and specifically to their critical care division, where technologies and tools relative to human volume assessment are manufactured. I will not be mentioning any specific products. I am also a founding member of the International Fluid Optimization Group. It is a nonprofit group of clinicians and clinician scientists. It is housed at UTMB Galveston. We are dedicated to the 5 R's. Anytime you reach for a bag of fluid, it does not get spiked unless you have an appropriate answer to the following. Is this the right fluid at the right time? Is it going in at the right rate? Is it going in at the right amount? And am I guiding it by the right measures? The content of this talk I put together for you. Every slide has a reference. I am more than happy to give you the 88 megabytes worth on a disk. If you so want it. We have an aggressive agenda. We're going to talk about the foundations of perioperative goal-directed therapy and volume optimization in at-risk surgical patients. In so doing, we're going to talk about Sarnoff curve predictions. Dr. Starling, he did not come up with a curve. There is no Starling curve that you'll see in any of his publications. It was actually Sarnoff who took Starling's data and made a curve. So we're going to learn about Sarnoff curve predictions based on dynamic indices, delta stroke volume, that's a classic Starling experiment, and a particular point on a human Starling curve known as SV max. that point where further fluid therapy does not augment cardiac output or perfusion, okay? We are going to take a step back, and we're going to address why is getting the fluid right so important in surgical patients anyway? We are going to define and compare the utility of different types of fluid responsiveness measures, static measures and dynamic measures. And in so doing, we're going to all understand how to interpret a receiver operating characteristics curve. We're going to revisit, given the ever-present medical technology that we now have, the utility in the perioperative space of the passive leg raise, or reversible volume challenge, RVC as it is being called. I'm going to tell you right now, you cannot use a central pressure, CVP or wedge, to determine volume responsiveness or the need or requirement for fluids in a human being. You cannot use a CVP to do anything relative to fluids in a human being. And finally, we'll end off with some fluid theory. What's the right fluid and how should I give it? At the very foundation of this talk is a fundamental truth. And that fundamental truth regarding human hemodynamic measurement and human beings and their outcomes is as follows. Monitoring devices do not improve outcome, no matter how many we attach to our patients, unless they are coupled to treatments or treatment protocols which are known to improve outcome. Now, surrounding this foundation is a critical concept from population science called the clinical implementation gap, which many of you know about. We know that medical knowledge increases exponentially over time, but we also know that that knowledge applied to patients can only be described by a much flatter curve. This difference between what we actually know and what we apply is known as a clinical implementation gap, and today it is measured between 15 to 17 years from a bench concept to the application of a human being. Okay? Now, relative to what we know on this topic, this recently published survey of American and European anesthesiologists, we're only going to focus on the American data, as to how anesthesiologists in the United States manage high-risk surgical patients, this will describe the standard. Relative to what we know, I'm going to cover that in this talk that has been put together for you called Strategic Volume Therapy in At-Risk Surgical Patients, an Individualized Approach. Okay? What's the goal? The goal is for you to take what you learn, share it with your anesthesiologists, and shrink the implementation gap if indeed one exists in your institution. So let's begin. What do routine measures of blood pressure tell us? Well, the problem is that standard measures of pressure, blood pressure cuffs, and arterial catheters simply tell you the blood pressure. They tell you nothing about what underlies that pressure, the pumping function of the heart or the tone of the vasculature, which means that when the blood pressure falls, you and I are often left guessing as to the cause. And if we're guessing as to the cause, it means we're guessing as to the treatment. So if standard measures of pressure don't tell us what we want to know, then what should we be looking for? And in my opinion, a major clue comes from one of my many professional heroes, another surgeon, Professor Bill Shoemaker, whose name I'm sure you all recognize. Now, Bill Shoemaker has clearly dedicated his life to the understanding of shock in man, with over 470 citations in the primary literature. Several decades ago, he took several thousand critically ill patients. He normalized their mean arterial pressure, he normalized their heart rate, he normalized their systemic tone, and still he noted that 76% of these patients still died. Furthermore, he demonstrated that you could actually separate survivors from non-survivors of shock by incorporating and optimizing specific cardiopulmonary indices relative to oxygen delivery and consumption. Now, looking around the room, I know that there is enough experience here that you will say, well, a lot of his work suffered tremendous skepticism and criticism, and it did. However, in support of Dr. Bill Shoemaker are now 31 trials with an aggregate of over 5,000 patients on this topic. The data has recently been reviewed by three different groups, each using different statistical techniques, and they all show the same thing. The physiologic optimization using goal-directed fluid therapy for moderate and high-risk surgical patients reduces cost, length of stay, morbidity, and mortality. Now, relative to surgical morbidity, we're talking about reductions in infectious episodes, GI complications, acute kidney injury. Last May, in JAMA, Rupert Pearce and colleagues published this really quite definitive meta-analysis in patients undergoing major gastrointestinal surgery, and they demonstrated that goal-directed fluid therapy reduces post-surgical complications and therefore potentially their long-term consequences by 23%. Now, relative to mortality, this paper was published by Andy Rhodes and colleagues. It was a 15-year follow-up to Owen Boyd's original 1995 goal-directed therapy trial in high-risk vascular patients. And what Andy Rhodes demonstrated was that if you were lucky enough to be randomized to the goal-directed therapy group, you suffered a 3-to-1 survival benefit at 15 years. Now, celebrating the incredible contributions of Johann Christian Doppler and Werner Forssmann, he's a urologist, Edgar Atzler, Joseph Erlinger, the father of the pulse pressure method, Adolf Fick, Otto Frank, all these guys, when you walk into a modern operating room or intensive care unit, there are a host of technologies that are available to you and your anesthesiologists and your intensivists to provide goal-directed fluid therapy and volume optimization. Now, where all of these technologies shine is in their ability to provide us with easy-to-use targets, dynamic indices, and easy-to-perform now Starling experiments like delta stroke volume, which we'll go over. But before we talk about these specific indices, because all of the tools available provide them to us, I want to take a step back and answer the following question. Why is targeted fluid therapy in at-risk surgical patients so important in the first place? Right? The consequences of fluid edema are not simply cosmetic. We know that. Okay? Now, this question was best answered by Danielle Chappelle in a beautiful landmark paper published in 2008 in the journal Anesthesiology. The paper was entitled A Rational Approach to Perioperative Fluid Management. Now, the first thing they showed you is rather intuitive, and that is perioperative weight gain as a function of the liters of fluid your anesthesiologist administers. And if I give 8 liters, I can expect an 8-kilo rise in weight. Now, is that surprising? No, because, as you know, each liter is associated with a kilo weight gain. Now, I'm not showing you this study, so you know this, because you know this, and it's intuitive. Why I'm showing you this study and why this study is so important is it is the first to relate mortality as a function of fluid-induced post-surgical weight gain. And that relationship of overall mortality to weight gain is not linear. It is exponential, which means we have to get the volume right. Now, I don't care if you're the kind of anesthesiologist or nurse anesthetist or surgeon or intensivist who believes that fluid restriction improves outcome in major surgery, because there's plenty of data to show that. I also don't care if you believe that a liberal fluid strategy improves outcome. And the reason I don't care is because relative to perioperative fluid therapy, there are, in my opinion, 3 inescapable conclusions, and they are: if you give too much volume, it's bad. If you don't give enough volume, it's bad. What you assume the volume status is, which is undefinable, is probably wrong, like most assumptions. Now, Mark Bellamy in 2006, followed by T.J. Gann at Duke, now up in New York, and Maxime Cannison at UCI, they have all demonstrated this graphically, plotting perioperative morbidity as a function of intraoperative fluid load. Don't give enough, morbidity rises. Give too much, morbidity rises. Give right amount of fluid, where the patient is said to be fluid optimized and perioperative morbidity is at its lowest. Now, obviously, the right amount of fluid is going to be different for every surgical patient, which means that volume therapy must be individualized. Now, is there any data that individualized volume therapy in surgical patients improves outcome? Is there data? There's 3 decades worth of data, and all of it demonstrates the same thing. When you give to major surgical patients enough volume to get them to SV max, that point on their individual Starling curve where further fluid will not augment stroke volume, they have decreased morbidity, they have decreased days in the ICU, they have decreased ventilator days, so increased ventilator-free days, decreased length of stay in hospital, and, because it's associated with improved organ perfusion, enhanced organ recovery rates. Now, the thing that really bugs me about all this is that it was not the American Society of Anesthesiologists who first brought this topic to light. It was the American College of Surgeons, and this editorial, "Optimizing intravascular volume in patients undergoing major surgery is essential to reducing complications and poor outcome." But let me tell you, we are not going to be outdone. So a year later in anesthesiology, using the same term, it is essential that individualized goal-directed therapy, including flow-related parameters like stroke volume, be incorporated, and that now, but that was 2009, is the time to define this practice. Yes, this was from anesthesiology. Hurtful, some of you will recognize. Heinrich Kellett is a surgeon, and not just any surgeon. He is the father of enhanced recovery. And so, we responded, but we're not really doing it, and I'm sure you have the eyes to see that that's not happening in our operating rooms. But let me tell you, our intensivists will not be outdone by us. And so a year later, they responded, getting the preload right is the cornerstone and should be a minimum standard of care for high-risk surgical patients. Whew. Standards of care. In 2012, the Enhanced Recovery Society published that perioperative fluid management, you must achieve fluid balance by optimizing cardiac output and avoiding overhydration. It's a guideline. And in 2014, a stakeholder group pushing a national agenda for enhanced recovery as occurs in England through the National Health Service published a white paper in which they identify goal-directed fluid therapy as a critical component of enhanced recovery. And in 2015, the National Health Service in England incorporates goal-directed therapy and fluid optimization of high-risk surgical patients as part of their target initiative. Given all that, anesthesiologists are asked by Maxime Canison, what are your best predictors of volume responsiveness? And the answers in the top were cardiac output, blood pressure, down here is stroke volume variation, a dynamic index. God, this hurts. You have no idea how much this hurts. Let me ask you a question. Cardiac output, second most commonly chosen choice of your anesthesiologists. If I tell you, Kumash, sorry, that the cardiac output is 4, can you tell me this patient will respond to a fluid bolus? No, you can't. And if I tell you that the blood pressure is 120 over 70, can you tell me that they won't respond to a fluid bolus? No, but these are the things that anesthesiologists are identifying as predictors of volume responsiveness, and they are not. Now, down here is a stroke volume variation. It's one of the dynamic indices, of which there are 5 or so in existence today. They're all the same. Let's talk a little bit about volume optimization of at-risk surgical patients using dynamic indices. Stroke volume variation, pulse pressure variation, PVI, all of these things are available in your operating rooms today. From a basic science standpoint, we have known since the time of Adolf Kussmaul in the late 1870s that the arterial pressure, in fact, does vary with human volume status. It does. The question has always been, can we quantify this relationship between the volume and that arterial variation? The answer, courtesy of Dr. Frédéric Machard, was not actually available to us in perioperative medicine until 2005, in which point he, as a single author, published an amazing paper in anesthesiology on the cardiopulmonary interactions and volume status. And what Frédéric showed was that if you had a tool which gave you a dynamic index, and your patients are mechanically ventilated, and they have a regular rhythm, and these conditions are met in almost all major surgical patients, almost all. If you have that tool and those conditions are met, and that tool tells you that the dynamic index is greater than 15%, it means that your patient is likely to respond with an augmentation in cardiac output to a fluid bolus with unbelievable sensitivity and specificity. It's unbelievable, actually. Now, what these things do not mean is the patient needs fluid. What it means is, if they need fluid, they are likely to respond or not. Now, conceptually, you can actually use these dynamic indices to tell you where on your patient's Starling curve, Sarnoff curve, really, they actually exist. Now, you know that the Starling curve has 2 separate components, a steep component and a flat component. And if a human being lies on the steep component of their Starling curve, are they by definition volume responsive? If a person lies on the steep portion of their Starling curve, are they by definition volume responsive? Yes, they are. Okay? Now, you obviously can't see this in any given human. But if you are measuring a dynamic index, and I don't care how you measure it, and I don't care which one you measure, if it's greater than 15%, and I say 13, but there's a little range there, if it's greater than 15%, for sure, it implies all conditions met that your patient is, in fact, on the steep portion of their Starling curve. And what that means is, if they need fluid, and you give them a fluid bolus, they will travel up their Starling curve to a point that is flat where they are no longer volume responsive, and you will see that the dynamic index at that point is less than 12%. And when your dynamic index is less than 12%, it implies you are at SV max. Further, fluid will not augment cardiac output. It will only augment edema and whatever other complications follow the salt and water. Okay? Now, I told you before that the right amount of fluid, where the patient is fluid optimized, is associated with the least perioperative morbidity. It turns out that point right there has been defined. Beautiful paper. That point right there is associated with you achieving SV max for your patient. And when you get to that point, you stop giving fluids. There are two internationally defined components to stroke volume max, okay? Two definitions for SV max. There's the classic Starling experiment, where if you give a fluid bolus and the stroke volume changes or the cardiac output changes by more than 10%, they are, by definition, volume responsive. That's a classic definition. Now, we have dynamic indices. And if they are greater than 15%, all conditions met, they're on a vent, and they have regular RR interval, they are almost certainly volume responsive. And okay, and so if this condition is met, greater than 15, they are not at SV max. Less than 12%, they are. It's very easy to do in an operating room. Here's an example. Let's say I am using a dynamic index. In this case, I'm going to choose stroke volume variation. I simply monitor it. If the stroke volume variation is greater than 13 to 15%, I just keep giving fluid. I just keep pumping it, pump it, pump it, until it is less than 10%. And at which point, I know, by definition, my patient is at stroke volume max. And patients with, under the right conditions, whose dynamic index is less than 10%, should not be receiving fluids, because you're only causing harm. You can do this with a classic Starling experiment, looking at delta stroke volume. Remember Dr. Thomas Latta? Give a little bit, ounce by ounce, and watch. So we can easily measure today by either giving a fluid bolus or a passive leg raise, which we'll talk about in a moment. All of these technologies available to us show you the stroke volume every 20 seconds. And all you're looking for is a fluid bolus. You give 200 cc's. Did the stroke volume change by 10% or not? If it did, 10% or more, they're volume responsive. Give another bolus, give another bolus, give another bolus until the delta is less than 10%, at which point, boom, stop the fluids. Okay? Now, looking at it algorithmically, when you type in fluid algorithms into Google, you will find there are lots of different fluid prescriptions. But all of the fluid prescriptions today share in common two things. One, you give volume boluses guided by delta stroke volume or a dynamic index until a patient is no longer volume responsive. They are at SV max. At that point, boom, number two, you give 1 mL per kilo per hour. 1 mL. That is very different than what your anesthesiologists are taught. I can guarantee it. And the reason I can guarantee it is this is a copy of the most commonly used text for education in anesthesiology, Miller. And in Miller, it teaches the anesthesiologist and the anesthesia resident and nurse anesthetists who train with Miller the following. Totally unsubstantiated, completely unphysiologic approach. You shall give 4 mL of fluid per kilo per unit time if your surgical procedure is of minimal surgical trauma. Go ahead and define that. You should give 6 if it's moderate surgical trauma. And you should give 8 mL per kilo per hour. That's a liter per hour. That's 150 bags of Lay's chips. No, it isn't. It's 50. And so what you see here is a classic example of how we teach fluid administration to anesthesiologists. That's completely bizarre. Okay? This should not be done. How good are these dynamic indices at predicting human volume responsiveness? This is humans. They are undergoing orthotopic liver transplantation. And with that cutoff of 13 to 15% right there, you can literally divide human beings into two camps, those that will respond to fluid and those that won't. If the dynamic index is low, it means they're on the top of the Starling curve. If the dynamic index is high, it means they're on the steep portion of their Starling curve. Why is this important? Well, if I have a patient, your patient, and your patient becomes hypotensive. And in that hypotension, I determine that their stroke volume variation is 6. Should I reach for a bag of fluid? Low stroke volume variation, you're at the top of the Starling curve. Should this hypotension be treated with fluids? No. Okay? If your stroke volume variation or dynamic index, whichever you choose, is high, over 15, let's say it's 20, and your patient is hypotensive, they do not need a pressor or an inotrope. They need fluids primarily. If you give the fluid, you will see their pressure may or may not rise, depending on the actual problem, but at least you have ruled out that they are volume responsive and whether or not this hypotension is due to that. Because you can be volume responsive and you can be vasodilated and you give fluid and you're still low and then you need a pressor. Okay, but the key thing here is you can easily divide your patients up with these, and this is how it should be done. Now, it is clear today that the use of dynamic indices is far better than the use of central venous pressure for determining change in blood volume or the need to give fluids. This is an ROC curve. It's been demonstrated by many different groups already. It clearly shows that dynamic indices are far superior. Now, just a show of hands, how many people are confident in their ability to interpret a receiver operating characteristics curve? Okay, good. Let me show you very quickly. These things are all over medicine today. This is how you compare standard gold approach with your new approach, okay? Every test in medicine has a true positive rate and a false positive rate. Before you have anything, you have a blank sheet. You can bisect that sheet with a line that looks like that, and that line is called a line of indiscrimination. Now, if I have a test, and that test falls right on the line of indiscrimination, it means it's true as often as it is false. Is that a good test? No. If I have a test that falls below the line of indiscrimination, means it's false more than it's true, and that is not a good test. We look for tests on ROC that are above the line of indiscrimination. If it's way up there, that's great, okay? Looking back at the data, oh, by the way, when you look at an ROC curve in the literature, they don't put the line of indiscrimination in. So you put it in. And look at where CVP lies. CVP lies right on the line. Means 50% of the time it is accurate and 50% of the time it is not. Using CVP to predict volume responsiveness is no better than a coin toss. So whichever you have, if you have something in your pocket, just, okay. You cannot use measures of central pressure to determine volume. Are we clear on this? Are we clear that you will never ask what the CVP is if you're thinking about volume? Because there's no reason to do so, and those of us who know about this will only look at you funny. So the anesthesiologists are asked, what do you use to predict volume responsiveness and volume and your need for volume expansion? And 72% said central venous pressure. This is a problem. The fact of the matter is, Paul Marek, in his study published in Chest, clearly demonstrates that you cannot use CVP to assess blood volume change, and you cannot assess CVP, volume predictiveness rather, with a central venous pressure, okay? Cannot use CVP. Now, why is the study called The Tale of the Seven Mares? Because there is one study in the literature that included horses. And in horses, central venous pressure does correlate with the delta blood volume and volume responsiveness. So unless you're working at the zoo, do not use CVP. But if you are, central venous pressure is a very good measure. The passive leg raise as a result of available technologies has become a very important tool perioperatively. It doesn't work so well in the operating room for obvious reasons. And what is this? Now, I'm drawing an ROC curve for you. I just need one person to interpret the ROC, and I'll ask the question. This ROC curve shows you if a passive leg raise is a good test or not for the prediction of volume responsiveness. What's the answer? Yes. It's actually a beautiful test. It's way above the line of indiscrimination. I'm thrilled because now it's confirmed. That you will know how to look at these ROC curves. Okay, and basically you know what it is. There's 300 milliliters at least of blood in the average human's legs. So if we raise the legs, this blood will translocate to the central circulation, to the stressed volume, okay? And if your patient is volume responsive, boom, there'll be a delta stroke volume of greater than 10%. Now, if you raise the legs in your patient who is hypotensive in the recovery room, if you raise the legs and their stroke volume drops, the very first thing you do is put their legs down. Okay, well, anyway, here's the study that shows this. You raise the legs, and if the cardiac output actually goes up, great, put the legs down and give them a fluid bolus. And when you do, this is exactly what you'll see. You predict the volume responsiveness, you demonstrate that it exists, and then you give the fluid, okay? This is one of my patients, metabolic acidosis in the recovery room, but they are normotensive. Do normotensive patients need treatment? Yeah, of course they do. Look at this. Do you see this? This variation in the pulse pressure. So let's just quickly do a passive leg raise on my patient, and look at this. That's the blood pressure, it's 133, but it goes up, and the variation is what? There or gone? Gone. What this means, and this is a little delta of the stroke volume as I was measuring it, you hang a bag of appropriate fluid, okay? That's what they need. Now, we started off with the fundamental truth. Hemodynamic monitoring devices, no matter how many we apply, do not improve outcome, unless they are coupled to treatments or treatment protocols which are known to improve outcome. There are tons of tools to use. I don't care which one you use. They're available, almost all of them, to you. There are available protocols. They should be adhered to. They are evidence-based. They do improve outcome. Patients should receive balanced crystalloid solutions, LR or plasmolite, in favor of high chloride solutions like saline, except under very specific circumstances. In major surgery, goal-directed therapy is definitely something that you should consider. I strongly recommend colloid therapy for fluid bolusing and low dose, 1 mL per kilo per hour, maintenance with balanced crystalloids. Too dry? No good. Too wet? No good. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. Bloomstone.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Quick reminder.